The following program was pre-recorded. On WFAN, it's time for Hello, My Name is Craig, our weekly candid conversation about gambling addiction. Now, here's Craig Carton.
Hello and welcome to a very special edition of Hello, My Name is Craig. Craig Carton with you, and this is a radio exclusive, a one-on-one long-form interview with Matthew Boyer. Matthew, of course, for those of you that don't know, was the bookmaker connected to the widely reported scandal involving the interpreter for Shohei Ohtani, Mr. Mitsuhara, who has been sentenced to prison for a number of fraud cases for the better part of almost 5 years, 57-month sentence for Mitsuhara. And Matthew, for the first time ever, is willing to sit down and discuss the case at length with us here. Matthew, good morning, and I appreciate your time.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for your time. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's do a little background so people just get a sense of who you are. Where did you grow up? Where did you go to college and all that good stuff? Give me a little background.
No problem. I grew up in Cypress, California, which is in Orange County. Basically, middle-class neighborhood, you know, really good family. And, you know, I didn't go to college. I basically, at 18 years old, I had a situation where my ex-wife, who I was with since I was 15 years old, became pregnant. And so college and, you know, basically that was all out of the picture. Right. It was more about survival and taking care of a new baby coming into the world.
And how old were you when you first got involved with gambling or exposed to gambling, even well before you becoming a bookmaker and all that? Do you remember when it started for you?
Very clearly. When I was 12 years old, my parents got divorced. And it was a traumatic experience because we were the kids in the neighborhood that got, you know, when we wanted a baseball glove or a baseball bat for the team for sports, we would have the best. If we wanted whatever sporting events we played, whatever we needed as kids, we were pretty spoiled in that sense. And when my parents got divorced at 12, everything changed. My mom went from, you know, hustling, working three jobs from a bail bonds business company that my parents owned, which they lost in the divorce. You know, again, my mom was just really hustling and struggling. So we had four boys in a house, had three brothers, and it was kind of chaos because a woman who is working three jobs is trying to keep the house and trying to keep the chaos from occurring. So to answer your question, at 12 years old, I started hustling. I started, you know, selling baseball cards. I started taking small wagers throughout the neighborhood. And I mean, really small. You're 12 years old, 13 right. years old. And then they eventually, you know, turned into a poker ring. And I worked at the Los Alamitos racetrack selling programs and trying to get a hustle there. So the hustle mentality started at that age. And that's when I was, a paper boy selling the Orange County Register at night. I was the top sales kid at 14 in the county, won some records for selling the most papers. And so I grew up with my grandparents were also gamblers. So that we would go to the racetrack quite often. And, we always played Yahtzee as kids for money. I mean, $1, $2, even with my family. So growing up in that atmosphere, gambling was not so taboo in my family.
Sure. So yeah, being involved in gambling and surrounded by people who gamble was your norm. And by the way, and that's the way it is for a lot of people. You know, the racetrack is a focal point of that. And, you know, for a 12-year-old kid, if you have relatives that gambled, you know, you probably associated more with those relatives. You enjoyed it. You felt good. Maybe you had a couple wins. But gambling was clearly a part of your life well before your puberty and becoming an adult. So it was your norm, right?
Big time. And, you know, I enjoyed it. I associated gambling with smiles and fun, entertainment right. with my grandparents and my family, my dad, my mom. And so I never saw it as a taboo thing. I mean, you always heard the stories when sure. you're young, when I was, you know, taboo about bookmakers and backdoor alleys and mob and all that. But it intrigued me dramatically, especially at a young age.
You know, it's funny. Obviously, this show is usually meant to talk to people who are problem gamblers, compulsive gamblers like I am. So somewhere along the line, I don't want to make an unfair assumption. My gut is that you probably became a compulsive gambler well before becoming a bookmaker, or am I wrong on that?
No, your assumption is 100% correct. I've been a degenerate compulsive gambler my whole life. You know, the difference between me and many others is I have the business and something that fed it to where the problem of the actuality of the gambling was kind of overlooked. When you're making $1 million plus a month and you're, you know, you go gambling, you could afford it. So the problems usually occur for most gamblers is when they run out of money, start stealing, start committing fraud, start telling lies, which we all have done as gamblers. And you can't feed that addiction. I always had a business that was feeding it. So people didn't view me as a problematic gambler or, I mean, I was definitely compulsive. I was going to Vegas every 2 weeks, you know, with millions of dollars. But
what was the business you were involved in?
The bookmaking business.
Oh, gotcha. So the bookmaking fed your appetite to also gamble on your own. Got it.
It did. But, I, you know, let me backpedal. I was a commodity trader for 11 years. I was the number one retail broker in the world. In fact, I was about from the ages of 19 to 30. And so I had that going, but I was running my bookmaking business the entire time. I've been basically a bookmaker since I was about 16 years old.
So let me ask the obvious question. If you're killing it in the commodities business, was there ever a thought of, I don't need to be a bookmaker anymore? I've got enough, you know, liquid funds. I could gamble as much as I want.
It was quite the opposite. I wanted to get out of that business as fast as I could. I hated it. It was a business where 90 to 95% of my clients would lose their money in the market. It was basically a boiler room, legal boiler room, you know, operation.
Got it.
And it was great as far as it, making a lot of money as a young kid at 21 years old. The great part of that, which is all in my book, Recalibrate, I bought my parents' home that they lost.
At how
and
old?
At 21.
Wow.
Yeah. It was a $550,000 home, which now is probably, you know, $2 million home in Orange County. But I purchased the home at 21. I moved in with my, at the time, 2-year-old daughter and my ex-wife. And I felt like I was like the king of the castle to own a home at 21, especially the one that my parents lost. It was a lot of pride and joy. And I earned all of that mostly, I would say 90% of it was earned legally. The 10% was just, I was a much smaller bookmaker at the time. It was more for fun. And then that expanded very drastically because I was working basically in a Wall Street of commodity traders who were making more money they can ever fathom at a very young age, and therefore didn't have children, you know, were gambling, were, you know, chasing girls and doing drugs and cocaine and all kinds of things. So I didn't dabble in any of those things. I was just a family guy who was making a lot of money, but I did love gambling. So the gambling part was always there.
So that was always your number one vice. That's however you process the need to gamble or the need to risk things, gambling was the way you did it. You know, it's funny. I tell people all the time, speaking about myself, that once I went down the road where I became compulsive about my gambling, it also fed an out of control ego. And I wonder if you would acknowledge the same for you, that as a young kid, suddenly with more money than you know what to do with, both in your real job and your kind of shady job being a bookmaker, that it fed an incredible ego. Yeah.
Oh, no question. I have, it's funny you say that. I have in a jiu-jitsu studio that I own today. When you walk in the studio, the biggest quote across the wall says, "My ego is my enemy." And, you know, I'm a guy who, I don't care what anyone says, I have a huge ego. Most people don't own it.
Yep.
You know, I've had probably 5 Rolls Royces, a Ferrari, a Lamborghini. You know, I live in a very nice house. I've been on 150 plus private jets. You know, I've had all the entourages with me. I've gambled $4.2 million on a football game and then another $400,000 on the second half of the Super Bowl of the 2023 where the Chiefs came back and won. So when you have a $9 million swing on a football game, I don't care who you are, you have an ego.
Sure.
And there's no question that my ego is definitely my enemy.
Were you any good at gambling? And I'm separating gambling from bookmaking. I'm wondering if you were good at it.
You know, it's funny you say that. In my book, I describe exactly how my life went in gambling. From the ages of 21 to 30, actually 21 to about 28, I would consider myself a complete donkey. I went to Vegas like every other Joe, and I just didn't really play smartly and just gambled and lost, and I enjoyed it. And it was more about, you know, feeding the ego of, you know, going out and having fun and living a high lifestyle and not really, you know, treating it as a business. About 28, 29 years old, that's when things shifted because the numbers I was gambling were so high. I had a $2 million credit line at almost every casino in the country. And when you're risking $2 to $5 million in a weekend of, you know, baccarat, blackjack, whatever you're playing,
right,
you know, you got to really start honing things in. So I started counting cards. I learned how to do that. And then the problem with that is I got good at it, I started getting kicked out of casinos.
Right.
I tell a story in the book where the MGM Mirage Corporation, which I was one of their really good customers for basically 8 years, they sent me a letter and said, you're no longer welcome to any of their properties, which they own a lot of Las Vegas. And I was really, you know, dumbfounded by that. And I called my host and he said to me, you know, Matt, this happens a lot. It's when you're considered a non-profitable guest, you are no longer welcome. And I'm sorry, because you're one of my better customers. And I said to him, I said, well, explain that to me. I know what the word non-profitable means, but you know, I lost $3 million the first 8 years and then I won it all back. And now I'm up $8,000. That's the net. And he says, well, the problem is you're up over $2 million in comps. So, you know, being up 8,000 is not the problem. It's the other, you're becoming non-profitable.
They overvalued the free room, the travel, the booze, the clubs, and the food. That was the problem they had?
Yeah, because what's happening is, you know, now at that time, I was counting cards. I was playing blackjack at a much different level.
Right.
And I had more money than I ever had. So when you're younger and you're just going there and dumping cash, don't know what you're doing, just a normal gambler.
Right.
Yeah. They loved it. I was their best friend. But once they started taking things away from me, for example, the promo chips were gone, the shopping sprees for my wife, you can have a jet, but you can only get this comp. They're, you know, started taking.
You know, it's funny you say that, because I experienced that same exact thing. The one casino in the world where I think to this day I'm probably still the largest net winner is Hollywood Hard Rock. And lifetime to date, I'm up like $4.5 million there. And then it got, and I was clearly their best customer for a good 18-month period, you know, in 2016 and 2017. And then it would be, hey, guys, I'm thinking about coming in. Are we good with the jet? Well, not the way we used to be. Now you got to send us $500,000 in front money. And, you know, the G5's not available. And you can't have 10 rooms, all that kind of nonsense, you know.
Yep.
So
yep.
I have experienced that before as well. I got you on that.
It changes quickly, right? I mean, it's all about money. And as you know, you're as good as your last dollar. And as soon as you go broke or as soon as you're no longer gambling, which both of us aren't, they can care less about you and I both. And that's just the way it is.
Let's take a quick break and we'll continue for a few moments right after this on Hello, My Name is Craig.
Back to more of Hello, My Name is Craig on The Fan with your host, Craig Carton.
Welcome back to Hello, My Name is Craig. Happy to have the infamous bookie in the Shohei Ohtani scandal, Matthew Boyer. Matt, let's get back into where we left off. All right, so let's get into the bookmaking business. You're a lifetime gambler. You've got a small little book. As you meet more people with funds to gamble with, your book obviously grows. How long were you running a multi-million dollar book prior to the, you know, Mitsuhara stuff?
I would say probably from the ages of 25 to I'll be 50 in a few weeks here. So, and obviously I stopped booking about less than 2 years ago once I got rated. So call it a good 23 years.
God, so a long time. So, I mean, that's a lifetime to be an active sports book, especially at the numbers that you're talking about. Give people an idea at the height, not wins and losses, but total value of the book making operation. If you want to pick any random year, what type of money were you booking top to bottom?
Well, 2023 was the wildest year of my life. I took over $1 billion in wagers and $326 million from the interpreter alone. But, you know, I had many, you know, celebrities and athletes betting with me and, you know, just famous, I wouldn't say famous, but just very wealthy people and guys that own, you know, huge corporations, et cetera. And because of that, I was able to, I would say, facilitate more action and more volume than almost any bookmaker in the country. I wasn't the largest clientele-wise. My peak was probably 1,200 clients, but I was definitely the largest volume-wise.
Right.
I was known in the business for other bookmakers to push bigger players to me because they didn't want that action. They didn't want that risk. And I was kind of known, they called me Tattoo Matt in the industry because I obviously have some tattoos. And I had a little bit more of an intimidating presence when I was younger because I was much more aggressive about, you know, people owning money and collecting and et cetera, which changed as I got older and, you know, wiser.
Sure.
But anyway, they called me Elephant Balls because there was no bet I really wouldn't take as long as I knew the money was good.
Right. And you bankrolled it yourself or did you ever lay it off somewhere else?
Laying off is not a word I've ever used. I just took it.
Got it.
The only thing, if there's ever a thing that I did wrong, which is also in my book, there's a great story. I took these billionaires. There was like three brothers that were betting with me, and they beat the living pulp out of me. And I was younger. I was probably 25, 26 at the time. And they beat me for $5.7 million, which back then was, you know, like $100 million to me today. And anyway, I had to take equity from my home. I had to borrow money from people. I mean, they buried me. And right. That's a moment of my life I realized you just can't take bigger than you have. And, you know, I've done it many times and I've learned. But at the end of my career, before I got in trouble, that was the height of it. And that's when I took definitely over $1 billion through my website.
All right, so let's get into, you know, the story everybody wants to hear about, know about, the story that has kind of made you infamous, and that's Shohei Ohtani's interpreter, Mitsuhara, who, by your admission a few moments ago, in 2023, I guess it was, wagered a total of $326 million, and by his own admission, wasn't very good at it, lost a considerable amount of money. How did he first come on your radar, get introduced to you as someone who, A, wanted to wager, and B, had the backing to make the types of wagers he obviously was making?
Yeah, great question. I basically was friendly and, you know, had a number of baseball players betting through me and my website. And a few of them I was real friendly with. We would go golfing, hang out, play poker, go to casinos together. Truly just were actual friends with, not just business acquaintance. And as that relationship developed, of course, you get around the team. I was going to spring training, you know, hanging out with a lot of the players. And so one night I went to a Padres Angels game in San Diego, California. And after the game, we went to the after, I'll call it the after party, let's call it, after the game was over, where the team goes back to the hotel. And, you know, generally, as you know, in sports, a lot of these guys are on the plane gambling or whatever. In this case, it's in the hotel. They have basically not rented, but have the little private room that's not a actual suite, but a room in the hotel. And there was probably about 14 guys in there, a couple third base coach, first base coach, about four players, and me and some buddies. And we were just playing in a very small screw around poker game, you know, $2,000 buy-in, like nothing big, and just horsing around. And Ipe was there, and he loved to gamble, obviously. And a buddy of mine who was an agent for me for my website, he saw Ipe putting in some sports bets. So they started talking, and he mentioned that, you know, my operation and what I do. And we that's how it all started. We started with a really small account. It was a $1,000 per game, $8,000 credit line, which got maxed out, I would say, within 2 days. And then he asked for an increase. We moved it to $40,000. And then he blew up the $40,000. He immediately paid. And that's when the stakes got very serious, very fast. And that's when I had to take over the account, because as a bookmaker, when you have larger accounts, you're going to have eyes on those accounts a lot more. And also you want to have that personal relationship, because now it's becoming, you know, a very serious relationship that's important on both ends.
So when he first lost the $8,000 and then the $40,000, what was the method of payment?
Well, the $8,000 never got paid. It immediately got moved to a $40,000 credit line.
Gotcha.
We trusted he would pay. Then he basically lost the 40. He wired it.
And let me stop you there. At that point, do you know his connection to Ohtani or no?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I know he's the interpreter, of course.
Okay.
But I don't know anything else. I never even asked. And the funny thing is, well, I guess it's not funny, but the reality is I never asked him once if it was Shohei or Ipe, which we'll get into.
Mm-hmm.
But let's go back to the limits for now. The $40,000 was paid. Then I moved him to $200,000 credit line. And then he managed to blow that out the very next, I might even be the same week. My, you know, time frames are off. This 2 years ago.
Sure.
And obviously I had a lot of clients, but then he paid the $200,000, and then he wanted to go to $500. I moved him to $500, and then he lost $500 and paid that promptly. So everything he did was not only honorable, but by his request. I never pushed anything on him. He was asking for more. If I did what he said, he would have had a $100 million credit line. Because there was no appetite that would have satisfied him. And truly, it's sad where we stand today. But the numbers just increased so fast and so swiftly that I never had a chance to really sit him down and say, hey, you know, what's going on here? Because he even made, if you look at the text messages between that the government released, he even jokes about, you know, tremendously about himself, how bad he is at it, makes fun of it. He never seemed distressed. He, even when I met him many times, he would just say, man, I'm really bad at this. And I said, you're not alone.
Right.
You know, because
I've
lost a lot of money.
At this point, for a guy that's had the, you know, the lifetime of experience that you had, and then later in life dealing with, you know, extraordinarily wealthy people and clients, this to you is like, I got my whale. This guy can't win. He's a lousy gambler. And every time I raise his marker, if you will, he loses and he pays right away. It's never a problem. This is like a gift from the gods, from your standpoint, I assume, right?
Yeah, that's what, you know, made the ego even bigger. And now my gambling became even bigger because I have this unlimited resource that just kept losing money. Because there came a point where, you know, it was very obvious that he could only wire so much, you know, every few weeks. And, you know, now it's easy to see why, because we all know the facts now, and or most of the facts, right? But at the time, you know, he would say, hey, I could wire 500,000 in 2 weeks, or I could wire a million. And then he would. And so I would give him more credit knowing that, you know, even though he's down 8 million, 10 million, that he was going to continue that wire, you know, every couple of weeks. And it was feeding my ego and feeding my, you know, and to be honest with you, the more he owed, the safer I felt, because he did have a week where he won $4.7 million. And I have to be careful too. I got to make sure that I could cover whatever he wins. But if he has a negative balance of 10 million, 8 million, you know, he wins $4 million. I don't have to come out of pocket. It just comes off the figure.
And what was at the beginning of this, as the numbers start expanding dramatically, is he gambling on everything and anything? Was he gambling specifically on one sport? What kind of appetite did he have?
His appetite was 80% soccer. And it was funny, Craig. It was like the weirdest games. I couldn't even find some of them. You talk about Indonesia league and, you know, teams you've never heard of. There's no way that he knew one player on the team. Absolutely no chance. And that tells you, you know, you and I both have some serious degenerate in us, right? But when we gambled, I imagine you at least had a clue of what you're betting on, you know, who the team is or who's on the team. And in his case, I would say that there's zero chance of that. There's too many countries he was betting on I've never even heard of.
My conversation with Matthew will continue next week, part two, one-on-one, with Matthew Boyer, the infamous bookie in the Shohei Ohtani case.